When the drought ends, the war on weeds begins. If we lose the war, the weeds will win the nutrients, sunshine, territory, and water. And so we ask, which can best win the war on weeds? Animals, chemicals, or people?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1054th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Santiago who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. What on earth is a weed? That's your question.
I've got reggae music in the back of my head already.
You got what?
Reggae music bumping
reggae
loud.
Reggae music, okay. Not that kind of weed we're talking about. What other kind of weed are we talking about?
Okay, like
when
the
people
kind
say
of,
get rid of the weeds, what are they talking about?
Like those uglies out in the yard that aren't flowers, not grass, nothing useful, I guess, not food.
There you go, nothing useful. Uh-huh. Okay, good go. Also with us, we have our intern producer, Sarah Rozai. Sarah, have you ever been tasked with the job of getting rid of weeds?
Yeah, actually, growing up, pretty often, my parents would definitely task me with weed removal.
There you go. So that's the subject today, folks. This winter brought an end to the drought out west here in California, at least, for a time being. There's now snow in the mountains, water in the rivers, lakes and streams, and weeds everywhere. All are grateful for the water, but wonder what to do with the weeds, because if we leave them to grow on their own, they will win the war for nutrients, sunshine, territory, and water. What to do? Out of concern for the environment and people, the municipality in which I live decided some time ago to ban weed-killing herbicides like glyphosate, which is called Roundup. Bravo, said the weeds as they grew to the sky. Achoo, said everybody else. That the government decided to ban herbicides may well be good for the environment, and it might make us all happy in that respect. But the growth of weeds somehow must be managed, or they will take over our environment. So having ruled out the use of weed-killing poisons, the government is left with but two means of control, animals or people. Of course, government chooses people as a means of controlling weeds, as more people means more government, and all is happy. The strategy allows weeds to grow through fluorescence into senescence before striking them down with laborers armed with weed whackers. But what if a shepherdess and her critters were turned loose to fight the war on weeds? Could she and they be more effective and efficient at winning the war on weeds than people and chemicals? Well, that's the question we have on the table today. And here to help us find an answer, chew on an answer, I guess we would have today, we have the Brittany Cole Bush, who is the urban shepherdess of BCB Shepherdess Environmental Services. Brittany, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Glad to have you aboard. And thanks to Joel Salatin for recommending this show and our guest, Brittany, today. Joel was up there doing a benefit for you here recently.
That's right. We had the pleasure to welcome Joel in our little beach town above San Francisco. And he came to speak at an event called Pastoralism Prevailing. And we are celebrating the lifestyle of the new pastoralists. And that is how I define myself in my work.
Well, now, if I were to ask Jason Struby, the engineer, what a pastoralist, or Sarah Rozai, Sarah, what about you? What is a pastoralist?
Pastoralist? Honestly, I'm not quite sure.
Not quite sure. Jason, do you know what a pastoralist is?
I'm at a total loss.
Okay. Brittany, what is a pastoralist?
Well, I'm gonna take it to the definition of a shepherdess, and then that will give us a good picture of what I define myself as a pastoralist. Traditionally, a shepherdess was a young pastoral maiden. So this young pastoral maiden was one who worked on the land with animals in generally gorgeous bucolic settings, rural. And I have a little bit of a mixed mashup in that I work in urban spheres as well as rural. So pastoralist to me is being a young pastoral maiden out on open spaces.
In the city.
In the city.
Okay, so there's a real fun juxtaposition there, don't you think? A pastoralist working in the city. It's kind of like my book, Metro Farm. The two don't seem to go together, and yet you're making them to go together. So the subject today really is weeds, and how did you come to be a pastoralist in the city attacking weeds?
Well, that's a fantastic question, because my story really becoming a pastoralist began in Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. Where I went to the University of UC Santa Cruz and worked on a 1,200-acre ranch in the Watsonville, Santa Cruz Hills. And I was working
with a student?
Rancher. I was a student at the time and a student of permaculture at the time, and met the rancher at that time while I was doing a PDC, permaculture design course. And he was doing an incredible thing using livestock to reduce the encroachment of coyote brush on his ranch, because he was really excited about encouraging perennial grasses on his ranch. So I, over a course of 3 years, documented what the animals were doing using this high-intensity, low-duration type of targeted or prescribed grazing. And after 3 years, I was sold that this could be used in open public spaces in a more broader context, and I ambitiously went after a contract in the East Bay Regional Parks District, and we won the contract and started grazing with over 1,200 animals that have now grown to a herd size of 2,400 animals on the urban periphery all over the Bay Area.
Wow. So the first thing that strikes me in this notion is that you're going after a contract with government, and it's kind of weed abatement, right? You're fire abatement. You're trying to get rid of fire hazards. If you're a city government or a municipal government, you have to figure out how to control the weeds, cut back on fire danger. Otherwise, the whole place burns down and you're in big trouble. But the notion of bringing in a young female pastoralist with a bunch of sheep. Now, how did you go about aggressively going after that contract?
Well, you know, I think a lot of when people ask me, how did I get started in this? Well, I don't feel like I searched for it. I feel like it was really quite a calling, because it's such a unique job title for a young millennial. So, you know, when you're able to see there's a need and you are on the other side of it, and where you say, hey, the two things can be connected and some really cool stuff can happen. That's kind of how this whole vocation began for me, is just seeing, two things that needed to be bridged. And fortunately, the public organizations over, out here in East Bay have really utilized, grazing animals for, I believe, over a decade now. And so the opportunities are growing and growing and growing as more
with
open
the weeds,
are
so to
acquired.
Speak, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's exactly right.
Growing
it's
with
exactly
the weeds.
Right.
And then when you so it was kind of like a little bit of serendipity. You were working on a permaculture course, and the permaculturalist that you were working with was using animals. And now, had you ever been around animals?
You know, quite honestly, I had never spent very much time with small four-legged friends. You know, I grew up around horses, but never sheep or goats or cattle even. I'm from Southern California, right near the oceans of North County, and I really, that wasn't a part of my cultural upbringing whatsoever. So at that time, working with sheep and goats was pretty abstract, especially when you start thinking about the urban corridors.
Mm-hmm. And what did your parents say when you called them up one day and said, Mom, Dad, I'm going to be an urban shepherdess.
Well, first I had to explain to them what that meant. But then the second part was that they're absolutely thrilled. I think I'm really blessed because I have parents who are, you know, they're my biggest fans. And I don't think they fully understood what it was that we were doing until they're able to see on the ground what it looks like.
And now you're starting your own business, BCB Environmental Services?
Yeah, I've branded myself BCB Shepherdess, and I am consulting on both private lands, land with private landowners, and on public spaces, open spaces, land trusts, parks, other public utilities,
good,
districts.
Okay, so we're going to
teach folks how to do it.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to consult with you about how best to control weeds. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson, Brittany Colebush, and you right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Well, the drought is over, and the weeds are back, and they're coming back with a vengeance. In some of the city green belts, I see weeds up their chest high now. Now, our municipality decided some time ago not to use chemical defoliants like glyphosate or Roundup, and they decided that we're going to be kind to the environment and not use those toxic substances. But then what? Got to do something, or those green belts turn into pretty ripe fire hazards. So you have to do something. What our municipality did was decided to hire people and put weed whackers in their hands and put them to work. But boy, that's really expensive if you think about all of the things that are involved with hiring people these days. So is there an alternative? Well, let's call on Brittany Colebush. She, the urban shepherdess of BCB Shepherdess Environmental Services, and we'll ask her. Question on the table. Go ahead, Sarah.
Brittany, I was wondering, you had called yourself a separationist earlier. So I was wondering, how do you consider yourself a separationist while simultaneously still working with the city?
Well, that's a good question. I think that the working on in the urban periphery and parks that line our urban areas, I'm not quite in the urban area and I'm not quite out. I'm right on the edge and the intersection of public being able to come and experience what animals are doing on these urban peripheries is allows that connection between the outside of the urban space and the inside.
It's kind of where the cement ends and the ground begins, is where you find the weeds, right?
That's right.
There you go. And I guess that was my notion with metropolitan agriculture as well. It's not really on the rooftops and down in the urban core. It's really on the periphery or metropolitan areas in general. So we're talking about weed abatement and the necessity to abate weeds. You know, having been raised in Montana, I was acutely aware of the Plains Indians and their practice of burning the prairies. Late in the summer, they would set fire to the prairies, and the grasses would just burn up and then get rid of all of the stickers and whatnot. And you could walk on the ground in your moccasins and also replenish the soil for next year's grasses, which would make it a great place for the animals to come and graze and thus your food supply. We don't do that anymore, do we?
No. In California, you know, the only burning that really is that is happening is most of it is wildfire, and mm-hmm. we don't have the same type of animal impact that we once did in our open lands from megafauna that we had from centuries ago. So no, we don't have that same type of effect.
And as a matter of fact, we don't really have the grazing animals like we used to have. The animals that we do have all seem to be penned up, right?
That's right. That's right. Conventional agriculture confines animals and is really the very opposite of how animals once roamed on our open lands.
So is what you are doing with your goats and sheep kind of reminiscent of the way things used to be before they were all tamed and put into fences?
Absolutely. We're trying to mimic those same types of patterns that those ancient herds have done on our lands by actually having a very large, high impact of animals in one space, but then we're moving them very quickly. So it might be high density and high impact, but it's very low duration. And it's the same way that the ancient herds moved on our landscapes based on the pressure of predators. And so we're actually mimicking these awesome ancient patterns that were once bringing this positive impact on our land.
Could you explain that one more time, the ancient patterns of the animals moving by virtue of being chased, as it were, by predators? How did that work?
Yeah, so there's this amazing relationship that herd animals have with the pressure of predation. So let's take it to Africa. Say we have a huge herd of zebras. Well, the zebras, they're much more safe if they're in a large herd and close together. And they actually end up getting closer together and moving a lot faster when they sense there might be a lion nearby. That impact of those animals all bunched together, you know, churning up the ground and dunging and urinating in that ground, it has this incredible impact on that landscape. And they do this, it's basically an instinct and culture of these herd animals, is that when they feel that pressure of that predator, they gotta move. And so we're in some ways mimicking that, instead of putting a predator on, you know, with our animals or sheep and goats in these open spaces. We use temporary electric fence line that is, you know, it's not a harmful voltage, but we're using solar panels to charge our batteries that then charge these electric fences and confine the animals into a small space. And then we move them every day. We move the animals in this high density every day. And that, in effect, mimics some of those things that we're speaking of.
Now, when you tell people that you're trying to manage urban environments by mimicking the way life used to be before mankind strode upon the land, do they look you with kind of curiosity and think, what on earth is she talking about?
Yeah, well, I don't think I start the conversation about going straight to the mimicking of ancient herds. Uh-huh. I think where we start is,
what, to get rid of your weeds, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or, oh my gosh, I've never seen 400 goats in our park. Or I have never seen poison oak be devoured that quickly. You know, those are the kind of conversations that begin. And then further into it, I can start kind of bringing it back to the mm-hmm. foundation.
Sarah?
So, Brittany, if this is such a green and sustainable way to get rid of our weed problem, why isn't everybody doing this?
Well, you know what? I think it's happening. More and more agencies all over the country and even all over the world, I hear, are using prescribed grazing as an alternative to fossil fuel equipment and machines. I believe that it's definitely taking hold in places that are not just urban, but even agricultural areas where invasive species encroachment is a large concern.
Which is how you got your start, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. It wasn't in the urban space whatsoever. It was in a rural setting, and by using these animals, we're able to really affect the soil condition, which then starts switching the conversation. Those weeds don't want to be growing in that type of soil when it's starting to improve.
Wait a minute. Say that again. Now, weeds don't want to grow in that kind of soil when it's getting better. Wouldn't weeds want to grow in good soil?
Well, the definition of a weed for different people are different things, of course. But when I like to call them undesirables, and these undesirables are very resilient plants, and they are able to grow in disturbed soils that maybe lack nutrition or nutrients. When you start bringing animals into the picture, they're fertilizing and bringing some activation into soil, which then allows desirable plants and forbs, grasses and forbs, to grow. So it's actually the transition of the soil's health that brings weeds into desirable, be it perennial grasses or wildflowers or things like this. So it's not just the reduction of the weed and then the good stuff grows. It's actually more that we're transitioning the health of the soil to accommodate more desirable vegetation.
Well, imagine that. Not only are we getting rid of weeds, but we're building the soil and thus improving the opportunity for more desirable plants to live and thus building our environment. Wow. Well, we can get rid of weeds. It sounds more exciting than using glyphosate at the moment, which is against the law. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, Brittany Cole Bush. Can we use animals to get rid of weeds? All those weeds. Oh, my goodness. Well, it's been a long drought out here in the West, 4 years of really dry weather, bone dry weather, and then it rained. And it rained, and the mountains are now filled with snow. The rivers have, and lakes and streams have water in them, and everybody's happy, especially the weeds. They're very, very happy indeed this year because they are running amok. And in our town, in the green belts that surround our community, the weeds are almost chest high now. And, my goodness, what are we going to do with them? Got to do something, otherwise they turn into a fire hazard. And California being fire country, you know what that means. So there was a time when we could use weed-killing herbicides. We can't anymore. The government has decided, at the urging of the people who live here, to stop using the herbicides. No more pouring the poison on the ground. That leaves two means to deal with them. One is people and the other is animals. Well, we're currently using people. You know, you hire people, you go out and use weed whackers and they chop down the weeds. That's really expensive. There may be an alternative, and that's what we're looking at today. Using animals. With Brittany Cole Bush, who is the urban shepherdess at BCB Environmental Services, Marin County up there. And hey, that's pretty good weed country, Brittany.
Looks like we lost her for a moment. We'll get her right back. We got a question, though.
Looks like she's calling in right now, so we'll pick her up.
Here I am.
Oh, good. There you are. You were back. I think you were out tending your goats for a minute, but we got you back.
That's right.
So you're headquartered up in Marin County. That's a really weed country. There's a lot of growth of weeds up there in the around the cities and whatnot. And here in the metropolitan area of San Francisco Bay Area, lots of growth there too. There would seem to be a lot of work involved. So that's what we're talking about, using goats and sheep to take care of the weeds in our environment. We're going to go to the phone really quickly and talk with Deneen, who has a question. Deneen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome to the Food Chain. Talk with Brittany Cole Bush. Fire away.
Thank you. Hi, Brittany.
Hi, Deneen.
Hi. I have a question in regards to your environmental services, which I think is a great idea. But do you need or is it required to get a permit for any of your work that you do on properties?
Ooh. No permit is, that's a great question. No permit is required for private properties that I've never come across any of that type of requirement. Okay. There's, in public lands, definitely there's a lot of steps for that, but not on private lands.
Okay. And is there any restrictions for or to use your services in sensitive habitat such as repairing corridors?
That's also a good. That is a good question. Well, what I generally do is I work with ecologists and make sure that the timing of our grazing is not going to disturb wildlife or very sensitive habitat, like ground nesting birds, or if there's endangered species listed, we make sure that those things are in consideration in the timing of our grazing.
Okay.
Well, how do you do that? For example, you know, the municipal government decides that you got to do something to control the poison oak in the riparian corridor, but there is a magic button willow plant there that's listed on the endangered species. Now, do you tell your goats and sheep you can't eat that plant?
No, it's really tough to try to get them to eat and not eat specific things. You know, it's all about the designing of the grazing, and it's the management of the grazing. So we're able to very acutely keep them out of places using our electric fence line. Sometimes we'll omit areas. Other times we will go through that area, but very briefly. So there is some animal impact, but not long enough to give any detriment to some of those species that we're trying to protect.
Okay, Janine?
Yes. Well, that's what the only two questions that I had, but I just wanted to thank Brittany for her great services and a great alternative to spraying. So,
thank you, and thank you for the call. Really appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, my goodness, there's a significant, you mentioned that there's a significant loopholes that you have to jump through in working with municipalities. What would those be?
Well, it's pretty standard. It's pretty standard par for the course when it comes to becoming a contractor or a vendor. We basically go through the same exact process as some of those folks who do the weed whipping, for example. We just become another vendor under the agency. And so when it comes to bringing animals on the ground, we have a couple different, you know, more logistics and complexities than folks who would just, you know, jump out and start weed whipping. We have a lot of logistics in transportation, in traffic, in ensuring that both our animals will be safe and the wildlife in which we will be grazing those areas are also taken into consideration.
Do you have to promise not to discriminate against certain kinds of goats?
Absolutely.
Okay, fair enough. And speaking of certain kinds of goats, tell us about the kinds of animals you use for your grazing services. Goats, I would assume. I know goats to be very efficient eaters of roses because I once took one home and parked it in the backyard of my mother's house and went in for 1 minute, and when I came out, all the roses were gone. And had I not been my mother's son, I probably would have been fish bait. But they are incredibly efficient eaters, and they do eat just about everything, don't they?
They do. They do. They have a wide palate. They're browsers. They like to taste a salad bowl of vegetation. They don't prefer just one thing. They really like to try a myriad of forages. So what we do on our projects is we bring a mixed species herd together of both sheep and goats because the goats are browsers and the sheep are grazers. So the sheep will prefer some of those grasses and, you know, the annual grasses and whatnot, where the goats will prefer some of the browse, like the higher things. They're like deer, they browse. So they'll get on their hind legs and they'll maybe eat the the lower limbs of a tree. They'll eat the blackberry or poison oak or crazy, crazy thistle or dandelion. They have the ability to eat those things much more, I guess, much more aggressively than sheep do. But sheep also do a great job, and that's why we have these mixed species herds.
So I would assume then that you look at the land that you're going to be working with, and then you know, mix your herd by virtue of what the land is.
That's right. That's right. So we first identify what the goals are of a particular area. So if we have 10 acres and half of it is brush and half of it and the other half is annual grasses that are in between the brush, but there's some poison oak and there's some blackberry. We determine how many sheep to how many goats, that ratio, based on what the landscape is and what the forage is and the goals in that specific space.
Good. And when we come back from this break, I'd like to ask you about the management of your animals and how you, and the difference that it's a different way you work with sheep as opposed to goats and how you haul them around. Oh my goodness, what a fascinating job. Right back. This is The Food Chain. What to do with all the weeds? Well, we could spray them with glyphosate, except you can't in the city anymore because the city's passed a law against using noxious pesticides or herbicides to kill weeds. Can't do it anymore. Could use people. Oh, my goodness. Having been a teenage herbicide, I know what a job that is. Hoeing weeds. Ooh, tough work. And having just spent a couple weeks fighting them back in my front yard, I know as well. So is there a better way? Is there a more efficient way? Is there a more enjoyable way, a better way for the environment? Well, Brittany Cole Bush, urban shepherdess at BCB Environmental Services, thinks she has the way, and it's grazing those weeds down with animals. Brittany, you talk about a mixed herd of goats and sheep. What kind of personality differences do goats and sheep have?
I love hearing this question because the personalities are actually pretty different. Goats are curious, and they are, if you're trying, they're curious and they're rambunctious. I think the best way to describe a goat is they're kind of the wild teenagers of the four-legged friends, where sheep, I feel, are less curious and less independent, but together in a big flock, they make for a very interesting personality altogether. So singularly, a goat has a big personality, but then a flock of sheep altogether makes for a really, really unique and dynamic interplay with those animals. So I love to work with both of them because they provide such different type of entertainment.
Now, do you talk with them?
Oh, absolutely.
Do they talk back?
Absolutely.
Describe that for us.
Sure. So I've been trained through just the experience of working with traditional livestock handlers from the Basque region of Spain. And the Basque sheep herders and that culture is a very important tradition in the West and sheep. And so the way that I've learned how to work with animals is through my Basque friends as well as the Peruvian men that I also work with. And these folks have trained the animals to have a dynamic relationship and communication. So when it's time for us to tell the animals, hey, we're moving from one paddock to the next, we give out a call, they call back, and that call allows for everybody in the whole entire herd to hear. It's the call, hey, we're going. And so it's actually those calls back and forth between the handler or the shepherd or shepherdess and then the animals that then communicate to the grander group of animals that allows that communication to say, hey, we're going, or, you know, take some attention because it looks like we're headed to greener grass.
We're moving on.
We're moving on.
Well, you know, those who worked with animals always talk to them, I think. I mean, if you get close to a critter, you talk to them. But the notion of them all responding like that, I guess, well, I guess they do, don't they?
Just they sure do.
They work with you.
Yep.
Sarah?
So you've managed herds that are have hundreds, even thousands of animals in them at one time. So what are some of the logistics that go behind your management of these herds of animals?
Well, the logistics of bringing animals into non-traditional places can be very complicated. And the only way it works is if you really, really take the time to make the appropriate prescription of those animals. And that includes how many animals and how to get them there and how and where they're going after they finish where they're currently grazing. So logistics is a big part of my work, because we want healthy animals and we want healthy land, and we also want happy people as well. So the logistics is crucial. The way we move them generally are in big livestock trailers, but we try to minimize that as much as possible by getting whole neighborhoods or whole regions to sign on to having the animals in their area for this prescribed grazing. And then we're able to herd them from location to location, which often means we have to close down roads temporarily, just as you would for a construction crew or something like that. That's what we do when we're actually moving, you know, hundreds of animals down the road from one property to the next to bypass having to use a truck.
Interesting. And have you ever had any issues in relating to having to close a road or having to keep the animals in one specific area for a period of time?
Well, there's always something that comes up. I mean, every day is new with livestock. The best way that we deal with those is that we have herding dogs that help us when if there is an escape. The herding dogs, we're able to work with them to go and get a stray that's maybe always, it's definitely always a goat, by the way. So if there's a goat that runs off and we're crossing a road or whatnot, we just deploy our herding dogs. I have a stock dog named Rue. She's a border collie. I have her go run and get that goat and bring it back. And that's usually the way that we offset any you know, animals that get out, is that we have these critters to help us.
Do the animals get excited when you tell them you're moving on to a new pasture?
Absolutely, of course.
It's like we're going to a new adventure, right?
Yeah. There's always something new on the other side of the fence.
Folks, this is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Brittany Cole Bush. We have Sarah, we have Jason, we have the whole crew today. We're talking about weeds, but not really. We're talking about using animals to improve our environment. Right back. Well, we have a few minutes left and so much to talk about. One quick question before we go to the phones for Brittany Cole Bush. Brittany, all of this sounds like way too much fun. There must be a downside somewhere. What's the bummer?
Man, I don't think I can come up with one. You know, you have to be someone who doesn't want to clock in or out of work. It is all the time. Animals don't stop being, they don't stop doing their thing, which is eating and sleeping and eating and sleeping and eating and sleeping. And so, As a shepherdess, it's my job to keep those animals healthy and happy and safe, and therefore I never get to clock out.
Good. Well, there you go. There's the bummer. Can't just take off and leave. You have to make provisions. Let's go quickly to the phones and talk with Ruth. Ruth, welcome to The Food Chain. Brittany Cole Bush is on.
Yes, Liz, but okay, you know, I have a quick question. After the sheep and the goats and et cetera are all finished working the land, approximately how long does it take before the gardener or farmer, you know, can come in and start planting?
That's a great question. Well, the answer that I would best give you is depends on what time of year. I think that grazing when timed really nicely with planting, can be an absolute benefit to your operation or your goals growing food. And the way that I would do it would be to graze, and hopefully we have rain upon the horizon. I would graze and then I would feed, because what those animals do with their hoof action is that they prime the soil, basically. They prime the soil and they fertilize the soil.
Right.
So if you're able to have, exactly. So you have them graze and then you can seed, and then hopefully we have that rain, and then it, you have the perfect combination for a successful growth.
To what extent can you scale this? Can you work goats through Ruth's garden and then scale it to work on a big ranch and then a municipal green belt?
Well, you know, I think it's important to identify that every project is different, and so our prescription has to be different. So if Ruth has 1 acre of garden or space that she wants to be grazed, with the animal herd size of about 400, we're able to graze 1 to 2 acres a day. And so if Ruth only has 1 acre, that means that we'll only be there for a day. So the logistics of having that small of a space and that little of time is challenging. So every project depends.
Mm-hmm. So it can be done, but the smaller the space, the more expensive it becomes.
That's right.
Because of we have to pay for all the logistics. Good. Ruth, do you have a follow-up?
No, thank you. That's very helpful.
You bet. Thanks for the call. So I guess, Sarah, do you have a follow-up?
Me?
Okay. Then my question is, does this make sense for a municipal government to really focus in on this as a way of getting rid of weeds, Brittany?
I think that more and more public agencies are going to adopt prescribed grazing for both invasive species management or weed abatement and fire hazard abatement. And with the benefits of building soil all
the
while.
There you go. Brittany Colebush, thank you very much. BCB Environmental Services. Brittany, thank you for joining us. Folks, remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't. Got to pay for those logistics of getting the goats around. Thanks, Brittany.
Okay. Thanks.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.